Welcome, citizens. You're listening to New Amsterdam Radio, the podcast for creatives. Here, thinkers and doers always have a key to the city. The mayor is in, so office hours start now.
New Amsterdam Radio starts now. It's another Thursday, which means another episode of Chat with Thinkers and Doers and all that jazz. Global Voice, the mayor, of course, in the mayor's office with you. Right now, as I record this, I am burning the sundown oil. It's a little bit after 6 o'clock local time. And as I record this and the sun's heading down, I know daylight saving time is this weekend. First of all, it's saving time, not savings time. But I'm already feeling the blues where it comes to the sun setting before 8 p.m. Man, I kind of wish that 8 p.m. sundown was year-round, but that's besides the point. How's everyone doing? I know your creative projects may be ramping up or slowing down depending on what your business or vibe or lane is. And I know the holidays usually comes with a slowdown for most of us. And so I say push on through. If you have to slow it down for family, something wrong with that. NewAmsterdam.com, that's K-N-A-W, Amsterdam.com. As you get to know more about the brand and the shows underneath that brand, of course, live entertainment venues as well, and New Amsterdam on that Instagram. Come over and say hi. You can see, listen to bonus content, clips from the shows that are released a week of. This week we're talking with Eric C. Williams, who does a lot, which seems to be a very common trend with the guests on the show. But to me, and I had to ask him this, it seemed like everything he was into was so different. You know, he was an attorney, he's a public speaker, a keynote speaker, a surveillance expert. So I really want to know how those things kind of cross paths. And I think what we can learn from that is sometimes what may sound different on the surface or disparate on the surface is what I think I use in our interview. When there's a through line between all of those, there is some overlap. So it's kind of cool. A lot of times when we try to go off into our own, we worry about whether or not we have to pick a lane or pick a niche, or whether you can do everything and be all to everyone. And some people say yes, some people say no. I think Eric is a perfect example of that. But if you haven't already, make sure you use promo code FLOBITO when you're using that SeatGeek. You see, I talk with people all the time, and sometimes when I get to know them, I take them over to live events all around town. And I use SeatGeek, the official ticket partner of New Amsterdam Radio and New Amsterdam Entertainment. Use promo code FLOBITO. That's F-L-O-B-I-T-O. That's me, y'all, for $20 off your first order. I mean, trust me, I've done that with baseball games with friends. I know with football games. You can't miss it. SeatGeek is the way to go. And as I record this weekend, it'll be the playoffs for the Orlando Aces, the only undefeated team this season in the regular season of Florida Grid League. Here's a chance for them to really stake their claim and take home all the gold. Give it up for the Orlando Aces. Follow them. Become one with them. Their social media point, the game is on point. Good luck to the Orlando Aces. And as for me personally, I'm on that X. I'm on that blue sky at Flobo Boys. But you did not hear, or you didn't come to hear me talk about my social media handles, because frankly, I say that every single week. You're here for hot and positive conversations with people in the know. So now, here is my chat with Eric Williams. Welcome back to New Amsterdam Radio, the podcast for thinkers, doers, and creatives. It is I, the mayor of Flobo Boys, in the mayor's office. And if you know our longtime listener to the show, you know I've done some silly things like run for office myself and coming in dead last. I'm a failure, but my guest is not. This is the opposite here. I have a very special guest. This is an attorney, speaker, and surveillance expert, Eric C. Williams. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. Can't complain just yet.
I just love how you just chill with it, man. You know, your voice is so smooth. I'm just like, man, that's that's like an evening out there.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Well, so let's get into it. You are from the city of Detroit, the D. I've never been myself, but I heard a lot of great things. It's coming back. It's being revitalized. What's been your take on that as a native?
It's been interesting to see. You see people with, you're seeing signs now that say, "Don't Brooklyn my Detroit." Because
I'm from Brooklyn, I get you.
I lived there for 17 years, man, so I definitely feel you. You see, so I mean, it's on the one hand, it's refreshing. On the other hand, as a native Detroiter who grew up in a city that was 94% Black, it is odd to look up and be in a restaurant and see no other Black people downtown. So there are parts of the city now where that happens. But on the whole, it's good seeing the city vibrant and people, you know, people on the grind doing their thing. So that part is refreshing.
I mean, absolutely. Like I'm a ballpark chaser. I try to go to all 30 MLB ballparks. So I got to make it out to Comerica. That's
all. Oh, yeah.
But here's one of the better ones in the league. So I'm looking forward to my Detroit adventure. So let's talk about this. Having your own business there, Eric C. Williams, PLLC, taking your talents as an attorney to help out others in the realms of intellectual property. What does that even look like nowadays? I feel like content's coming out everywhere. TikTok ideas and message boards and forums. Like, what is that like being in that space?
Well, it's bizarre in some ways because, first of all, creatives are an interesting group of people to work with, right? And I have to say that. And my sister is actually, I mean, she's an actress. She's actually on Broadway at the moment. So if you get a chance to go see Chicago, she's in there. She plays Mama Matron. So I have a very creative kind of family. My mom was an actress back in the day. So they're quirky sometimes. Mm-hmm. And how can I put this? So explaining the loss is sometimes the most interesting part of the entire job, right? So explaining, you know, what they own, what they don't. And creatives aren't necessarily the most business-minded of people. And these days, as you mentioned, content, right, the product of the creative, you know, imagination and talent of people is everywhere. And creatives aren't necessarily the people who are best at monetizing that. Mm-hmm. And so for me, working with everyone from, you know, artists to people who are involved in website design to clothing designers, helping them understand what they can and can't protect, helping them get a feel for actually creating systems to capture their intellectual property as they create it has been fun. It's fun. You see people who are used to just sort of pulling ideas, you know, from everywhere, suddenly recognize the value in what they're creating, and I'm sorry, as my daughter just walked by, and really getting into, you know, how can I put this, trying to find a way to incorporate the systems to protect that IP as they generate it, right? It means, so a more concrete example is, let's say you are working the visual arts.
Yeah.
Right. And you have other people that work with you that may at some point actually be responsible for creating something, right? But making sure that what they create actually, you know, belongs to your company if you've hired them, or making sure that as you create things, you know, you're getting copyrights, making sure that as you are using other people's intellectual property, that you're getting a license, or you're getting ownership transferred, and making that something that gets done all the time, as opposed to something you, you know, every quarter or something think about. Right. So that's what my business is kind of focused on. And that's what that's kind of the most fun part of my job.
So talking to the building of that platform and that journey, was it a situation where you had the idea of protecting those creatives and decided to go into IP law? Or was you, in the course of your law education, go, no, this is something I want to focus on after the fact? Like, what was the moment for you to say, this is my niche, this is my path forward?
Completely accidental.
Yes, you know, the best things in life are accidental.
Serendipitous is, I guess, how you describe it. So I was working for, I went to law school at Columbia. I was working for a very large firm there. And I loathed it with every fiber of my being. I was living in East Flatbush while I was, there you go, I got little Jamaican kids.
Okay. So, I'm from Flatlands myself, but Flatbush is literally down the block. Like, I'm on the border of Flatlands and Flatbush.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Okay. So I was working there. I mean, I was living there. I was working up in Manhattan. There were times where I would come home at 2 o'clock in the morning and then get, this is back when we had Blackberries, get an email saying, oh, we need you in the office at 5. And so I wouldn't even get out of, you know, I got taking a black car home and I wouldn't even get out. I just get back in the car and go right back to work. And there are a number of times, you know, you have the wife sitting there at the door looking like, ah, all right. And so it was horrible. And then I had some friends that ran an artist collective up in Harlem. And they asked, it was a nonprofit, and they asked me to help them out with some stuff. And so I helped them out with that. And I was like, oh, this is fun. I like this. I like my clients. I like the work I'm doing. And so it just sort of evolved from there. So I work for a nonprofit law firm that focuses on surveillance and social justice issues. I also have my own private practice, and that is where the focus is on AI and IP. So once I got into that and found out that I liked it, I set, you know, my own private firm up, and I've continued to work in that for the last, I don't know, it's been 15, 18 years at this point. It wasn't intentional, but you know, it's, you find a client that you like and just suddenly find yourself drawn into it. And that's kind of how I ended up here.
Man, absolutely. Sometimes they find like the path chooses you. And a lot of times the best things in life are accidents. Intangibles are intangibles.
Certainly.
So
be open up to the possibilities. That's the way to live life. You know,
that's the best way to live. I mean, I thought I was going to be a financial analyst. You know, I mean, I'm from New York, Wall Street's on the block, realty speaking. And now I'm in Los Angeles trying to do the content thing myself. So I'm with you with that. but you did mention working also with social justice and surveillance, and from the outside looking in, and I mean this all due respect, they seem kind of disparate, right? Like, how did you decide to bridge those two worlds? Or is there a bunch of overlaps and intersections that we're not seeing?
So there is actually kind of a lot of overlap in one sense. Right now, the point of overlap is actually artificial intelligence, right?
Right.
So anytime you look at facial recognition technology, which is an integral component of virtually every surveillance system around, it's the same thing that, you know, whether we're talking about large language models or, you know, suddenly creating books that read a lot like, you know, authors you know, or pictures being created that weren't really made by a human being, that kind of thing. So there's that overlap right there. And both instances, in both use cases, there are real advantages and there are also real threats, right? There's for example, there are a number of lawsuits going on right now that authors are upset, where authors are pressing claims that are based on the fact that artificial intelligence is being, programs are being changed, are being trained using their copyrighted works, right? So clearly that's an issue for, you know, creatives in that regard. There's a danger for small businesses that incorporate artificial intelligence into their own sort of day-to-day operations, not knowing whether or not what they're using is violating someone else's intellectual property, particularly copyright. When it comes to surveillance, the greatest danger is that we don't have, how can I put this? All of our constitutional rights, all the security we have in our home and our papers and possessions and the like, are basically premised on the idea that the police can't watch everyone all the time. Right. So if the police are watching you, there's something that sort of indicates that they're doing that. And it's not just sort of matter of fact happening all the time. With artificial intelligence, that's been changed. We literally can watch everyone, everywhere, all at once, all the time. And more frighteningly, connect whatever information we gather on whoever we see with information in dozens of other databases. So at this point in the state of Michigan, we have a huge database that actually has more people in it than this in the state of Michigan, and it includes social media, includes, you know, official records, driver's licenses, and the like. And if you, and it includes people who've not only been arrested or who are suspects, but people who are friends of people who were suspects and may have never been. So you got everybody in this database, and artificial intelligence could identify you, tie you to all this information in this database, and it can be shared across law enforcement agencies across the country. Now, that's frightening, right? In so many ways, not only because, let's say a place like Detroit, which has always been, you know, a real bastion for, you know, civil rights protests, for union activity and the like, that is, includes a number of racial and religious minorities. Suddenly you have the police with the power to surveil to an extent that should be really, really frightening to anybody who's ever paid attention to COINTELPRO, Ghetto Informant Program, surveillance of Muslims in the aftermath of 9/11. I mean, we kind of know it's going to be abused. And as a Detroiter and, you know, somebody who is really concerned about civil liberties, pointing out what these risks are and holding the government accountable is, you know, my day gig. So the tie-in between artificial intelligence, both the promise and the danger, is what is where the overlap is in the two jobs that I work here.
Yeah, the evolution or de-evolution of surveillance has been kind of scary for a lot of people. And as a citizen, sometimes you kind of put your hands up and you go, well, you can't fight City Hall, man. Like, yeah, you can get people to make pass laws or treaties to be crass with it, but how can you really enforce that from a citizen standpoint? What do you tell, like, potential clients or the man in the street who may not care or may say, yeah, I know it's a problem, but what can I do?
Oh, if I was dealing with those two kinds of responses, that would actually be an improvement. No, seriously. Let's not joke. Detroit is big picture. Crime is not what it used to be. I don't know how old you are, but I grew up, like when I was in high school, crack hit, and it devastated Detroit in a way that, you know, if you didn't live through it, it's hard to understand. Yeah. So crime levels are nowhere near that, but it would still be naive, disingenuous to say Detroit, like a lot of major cities, while safer, still have issues with crime, and in Detroit particularly violent crime, right? So many people have gotten to the point where they are fed up and frustrated that they are willing to accept what would otherwise be unacceptable police behavior just because they like anything to make me safe. It doesn't help the police frequently lie about how effective the particular surveillance program might be. They lie about how much it costs, or they hide those. That's really been a problem here, hiding exactly what the expense is. When you tell people, you know, look, this is a bad thing, right? These are, and they're like, yo, if you can catch the dude that broke into my car, bro, I don't even care.
Right.
And that's, and particularly older people who grew up, you know, they're my age and older, who grew up when crack was really just rampaging and the streets were really violent. And those are the people who are asking for more police protection, and their attitude toward that hasn't shifted. So it's tough to do that. This is what I try to tell people. City of Detroit spent $20 million over the last few years on surveillance. I want you to look around Detroit and tell me you can't think of how $20 million in government spending could have been made in ways that make the city safer than that surveillance. How about job training? How about education? How about something to address mental health or substance abuse? Or how about, you know, just cleaning up the neighborhood? Those kind of things on the front end have a greater impact than surveillance, which at best might help you catch some people, but studies after study has shown it doesn't really prevent crime. So if you want to make the place safer, how about you invest in things that make the place safer as opposed to surveillance. And when you put it like that, people go, yeah, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But that involves a conversation. It's not the kind of thing you can just get across with a social media post, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. I see that a lot of us get our news by curated memes and text, and we follow our favorite journalists like rock stars and see what they're
doing. Right, exactly.
It's kind of an interesting thing, you know. I mean, so just for full disclosure, I'm 38. I was born 1985, so I was born
after.
Yeah, exactly. It's a baby. It's a baby with back problems. So I came right after the first original ripple of the crack epidemic. But I grew up in a time where it really was the intergang warfare, Latin Kings and the war of the Crypto-Decepts and all that stuff too. And that was really the answer. It was kind of like, we need more cameras. We get more cameras. They don't have that problem in X city halfway across the world. Well, let's do more of that. And well, you know, cameras are effective to a point. You know what I mean? It was kind of a ceiling on that. So I got to ask, what keeps you going, man? I'm sure there's some days you come home and you take the tie off, and you just feel beat down. Like, what makes you go? I got to do tomorrow too. Like, what?
So I've been kind of I've been an activist basically all my life, right? So I was an activist in undergrad, kind of always been that way. And then I actually wanted to be a public defender, but Kings County public defenders weren't hiring when I came out of law school. So my wife was like, at the time, was like, these big firms they're paying, you need to take that job. We got three kids. And I was like, okay, I guess not a public defender, but it's just something I've always felt was really important. And yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna lie. There are days when you look at it and you go, I'm fighting a losing battle. I mean, I lost a court case recently, even though the judge were appealing, but even the judge basically admitted that the city should have done a better job, that they didn't actually do everything they needed to do in order to expand the surveillance program. The judge literally was just like, oh, well. And that kind of thing gets really frustrating, right? But if you believe in it, you take a break, you know, in my case, I go and buy some baklava, sit by the river and drink some black coffee. So like, okay, all right, we'll get back at it tomorrow.
Why do I picture like a smooth jazz song happening when it's it's like, man, that was a rough one. No, I respect that. A lot of us,
more likely to be Tupac.
Got to keep your head up. Because it's a question we always ask our people who are fighters. Like, how do you refill that cup, quite literally, your case of coffee? But how do you refill that cup when you do have the challenges and pressures of a job? Because we're all human beings at the end of the day, you know? So I want to shift gears a bit, because above all that, you're also, I've shifted over to keynote speaking, which is fantastic, because you're able to share your expertise in multiple disciplines. And I guess the question I have is for a lot of my keynote speaking guests is like, what made you decide to share? Because there's a lot of experts out there that says, buy my book, you know what I mean? You know, pay me, you know what I mean? But to be able to go out there and share that knowledge with different people who may come from different angles or have different experiences or different questions to ask, why was the appeal going there?
So again, kind of serendipitous. People asked me to come and start speaking on particularly surveillance and then later on AI. So it wasn't initially something I was seeking out at all. It was people said, hey, we keep seeing you talk about this, like on a news clip or reading about it in the paper. We would like for you to come and talk to these folks. And I am not as outgoing as my sister by any stretch of the imagination, nor can I sing. But I do like connecting with people about things I think are important. So it just sort of evolved. I'd evolve from there, and getting someone who maybe didn't see, you know, why something was particularly relevant, become engaged and energized. I'm like, okay, that's a lot better than it was before, you know, because it's going to, the changes that we need to see aren't going to happen, you know, grand scale. It's kind of, in many instances, it's sort of, you know, each one teach one kind of thing in order to get to our community, just because people, as you said, tend to rely more on, you know, sort of curated memes than, you know, mass appeal media these days.
Yeah, it's a tragic. Hopefully there may be a pendulum swing. I kind of hope for that. That's kind of like a thing. I mean, if you look at the trends of like how Yale journalism was 100 years ago, and we kind of went back to more of the hard reporting, but maybe wishful thinking. Maybe I am the old man.
No, that's a good point. I like that. Everything is cyclical. So, you know, that we all kind of rely on that, right? To keep us going. Like, this is going to get better.
Yeah. And can I ask you a side question? I know this is out of left field, but you're also an affordable housing advocate, which I appreciate because I live here in Los Angeles and I'm in an apartment that I don't really like that much, but it's rent controlled. So I ain't leaving. You can't make me move. And there was a big push for affordable housing because I'm sure the local homeless problem has become a national problem. Los Angeles is used for a lot of examples for home. Oh, cities in California are. They are building apartment complexes all over Los Angeles in the guise of affordable housing. And I'm looking at this, I'm not even a construction person going, wood frame on five floors, it's not really the most sturdy building materials. Who is this affordable housing for? You know, I feel like when they're built, it is say luxury homes, high ceilings, we have a gym inside. Can people really afford things at market rate? And what is truly affordable? Maybe you can help me out with that.
Yeah. So affordable is sort of a funny word, right? So from the government's perspective, housing is affordable if you can get that housing spending no more than 30% of your income, right, on housing, which includes rent and utilities, right? And they do it by area median income. So they look at your area and then say, if you made the median income here, which is half people make more, half the people makes less, right? Could you afford this housing spending no more than 30% of your income? If so, then that housing is affordable. And then they go, if you made 80%, could you afford it? And then they say it's affordable housing at 80% AMI and the like, right? So that's how they classify affordable housing. But the problem that happens in most major like metropolitan areas is the suburbs are frequently more affluent than the city, which means that the median and the area that they do isn't a city, it's a larger region than that. So when they talk about affordable, they're saying it's affordable for the median in the whole area, but the actual median in a city may be far less. So for example, the area median income for the area Detroit is in is something like, I don't know, like $60,000+. The actual median income for Detroit proper is $28,000. So if you make affordable housing for people who make 80% AMI, right, that's actually above market rate in the city of Detroit, which means money that is supposed to be subsidizing affordable housing is in fact federal money is in fact subsidizing market rate housing. The truth is we don't have enough affordable housing anywhere. And when we do have it, it tends to be one or two bedrooms when many times what you need are larger units for, you know, families of four, five or six, right? So we just don't devote enough money to it. In Detroit, we're trying to go to, we're trying to develop community land trusts, which are a different model for affordable housing. It comes down to the same thing as almost every social ill you can think of. The people in power will say, we don't have the money. And what they really mean is we don't have the money for you. Because if there is an international crisis, whether it be in Ukraine or Israel, we suddenly can find billions of dollars, but we can't find enough money to house people, provide mental health services, to improve education. So you're right, it's not being built for the people who live there, which is basically the definition of gentrification, right? Development being for the people who don't currently live in the area being developed, right?
Sure, sure.
It's a matter of priorities, and it requires people to be engaged if we're ever going to change it. But unfortunately, requires being engaged at the federal level because that's where most of the money for affordable housing comes from.
I guess I say this as a, well, I, my family still lives in New York. I was an ex-New Yorker, ex-Brooklynite. I kind of miss the community aspect, right? You had the apartments over the butcher shop and the laundromat right. and the art galleries, and you had that interaction. It does feel like now with planned communities, which I'm not saying they're bad over them. I'm just saying with the rise of them and these complexes, I just feel like everyone kind of shows up, they sleep, and they kind of scatter. And there's not really much of a vibe in a town so much as being like, oh, it's clean or it's not, right? It isn't like, oh, this is an art district. This is a Dutch history zone. It's kind of like, it's clean. It's good. It's not. It's bad, you know?
Oh, so you've noticed.
Yeah.
Organic growth isn't. Organic growth for communities is really not something that, it seems like it doesn't really happen anymore just because development is so, I mean, there's so much that goes into it, right? I mean, one of the big problems we have with affordable housing is zoning laws that prevent, you know, certain types of housing, the kind of housing that would have, you know, poor people in it, from being built in certain areas. And between zoning issues and the cost of development and the fact that households have changed, right? We don't have nearly as many multi-generational houses, housing setups as we used to, which we need more of. Housing developments don't take into consideration mobility, right? I mean, people who have mobility issues, whether it's from, you know, it's a condition or just simply from getting older, right? All these things need to be taken into consideration. And so that kind of stands in the way of the sort of organic growth that we'd like to see.
Yeah.
Planned developments is what you get.
It's enough to make you mad, but I like the fact you're still pressing on and making it happen. Eric Solanas, this is New Amsterdam Radio. Before we get you out of here, though, it's a couple questions I like to ask a lot of our guests, kind of fun questions, quote unquote. Yeah, your mileage may vary. Maybe like, this ain't fun at all, Flobo. What are we doing? But let me ask you this. Do you believe in days off? And if so, how do you spend them?
Right. So, yes, I believe in them very strongly. But so one of my jobs requires me to work. We only work Monday through Thursday. And so I spend my days off working on my other job. So I'm kind of always busy. But when I'm not, I am a huge college football fan.
Okay.
So, you know, just for the record, if you have any questions about
shout out to Michigan. Yeah.
Right. So I'm 45 minutes from Ann Arbor. I will drive up to Ann Arbor. I will grab tickets on StubHub, drive up to Ann Arbor on a Saturday like that, and support my Wolverines. I'm a very, you know, that's me.
I respect. Do you have a travel bucket list? If so, where else in the world do you want to visit?
So I literally just spent the last 3 months traveling, right? I had a sabbatical, so I was in Jordan, Egypt, Lebanon, Dubai, Hong Kong, the Philippines, Japan, Vietnam. So I just spent the last couple of months just everywhere, right? Yeah. And so I don't have a travel bucket list. I am trying to be about that nomad life.
Okay. No, I respect that. Yeah.
You know, I mean, my goal is to have a houseboat anchored off, let's say, either the coast of Portugal or maybe the Philippines.
Yeah.
I do my work from there and then fly out to go do speaking engagements. You know?
Yeah.
That's
smart.
That's the dream.
If someone's like, come visit me in Kansas, but like, I'm sorry, houseboat can't make it. I can't go out there. Who has the best baklava then? If you've been out there, like where should I go first for the best baklava?
Actually, I have some really good baklava in Lebanon. I've also had some really good baklava in Turkey.
Okay.
But Dearborn, Michigan, which has like the largest Arab population outside the Middle East.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple of bakeries through there. Just roll down Oakman Avenue, Oakman Boulevard, and you'll almost any place you drop in.
Yeah, respect to the community in Detroit. A lot of times where there was what they would call white flight, the Arab community pretty much held that city down, man. And it's cool to see that Detroit's exactly. Coming back. But Eric Zablins, man, thank you so much for being on the show, man. If everyone wanted to contact you, book you, or learn more about what you're working on, how do they go about doing that? How can they connect with you?
Sure, you can. Well, easiest way, Google Eric Eric Williams, Attorney of Detroit, or you can go to ewilliamspllc.com, and you can find me there.
Fantastic. This is New Amsterdam Radio, the podcast for creatives.
Thanks so much for listening to New Amsterdam Radio. Learn more about the show at newamsterdam.com. That's KNEW Amsterdam.com. Until next time, this city is yours.